Well, good morning, everyone. Lovely to see you. So I want to talk a little bit about Dogen this morning and this particular fascicle, just generally speaking, and then touch on the concept of the theme of menmitsu, which is loving attention or intimacy. So I really love Dogen. I don't understand everything about Dogen or all of his teachings, but that grows with time, and in some cases it doesn't. But you know, I so appreciate his dedication, and we'll learn a little bit about that as well as his transformation as a student as we study instructions to the Tenzo. But I want to give you just a little bit of background on him first, and then some of the key principles of his teachings kind of conceptually. So he was born in 1200 in medieval Japan, and he was a member of the aristocracy. The aristocracy was on the decline. The samurai class, or the warriors, was on the ascendancy, and his life kind of occurred at the midpoint. And as a member of the aristocracy, I'm sure that he was well exposed to many of those high court imperial activities, such as fine calligraphy, Japanese, Chinese poetry, flower arranging, tea ceremonies, etc., which I just want you to hold in the back of your mind. His father was apparently a member of the court, might have been the Privy Seal. There's a lot that's just not specifically known, and that's supposition, but you know, many people are making the same supposition, so I guess we can suppose that there's some accuracy. And he probably was illegitimate, or maybe, you know, not the, his mother was not the main wife, not clear. There's not a detailed biography of him at all, the way we read biographies today about more current people or even, you know, historical people in our country. At any rate, his father died. Oh, his mother was a daughter of a regent of the court. So between the two of them, he really was exposed to this aristocracy and aristocratic living, even though it was on the wane. And his father died when he was 3. And his mother died when he was either 8 or 10, something like that. But very, very early on, you get that he experienced impermanence very, very deeply. I mean, imagine what it would be like if you were to be orphaned by the time that you were 10. And in your immediate sphere, you were to have two key figures like a father and then a mother die and be gone, and what that could do to you. So for me, this is really significant. He really gets a very, very deep appreciation for how impermanent life is, right, at a very early age. He is, just as a little factoid, had apparently 11 brothers and three sisters, so a big family. It was at his mother's funeral that he had his first epiphany or moment of enlightenment. And it was watching the smoke wafting up off of the incense at his at her funeral that he again had another experience of impermanence, of the life, how life is so impermanent. And that was his first moment of enlightenment. He had an uncle who wanted him to go into business with him or take over his business, which was apparently quite successful. His uncle was his ward. And but it was his mother's wish. She had told him before she died that she wanted him to become a monk. And that's the path that he follows. I think he is about 12 or 13, again, the historical record is not exactly clear, when he joins the monastery. And he goes to a place called Mount Hiei, And that was a big center for the Tendai Buddhism. Tendai, T-E-N-D-A-I, was the predominant form of Buddhist practice in Japan at the time. And this was a center. And so he had access to all kinds of literature, libraries, teachers, etc. And he was very dedicated. He was, my feeling about him is that he was very, very precocious, really, you know, really longing for something, feeling at a very young age that this Buddhist path would lead him to something. And he didn't leave anything on the field, as we might say. He just went after it wholeheartedly. He has this question. This is the question that a teenage Dogen has that plagues him. Now I'm reading from Moon in the Dewdrop, which has a nice biography of him at the front. Both exoteric and esoteric teachings explain that a person in essence has true Dharma nature and is originally a body of Buddha nature. If so, why do all Buddhas in the past, present, and future arouse the wish for and seek enlightenment? So if we are already Buddha nature, why do we have to do anything else about it? And why do these ancestors and dedicated practitioners in the present spend so much time working and seeking enlightenment if we already have it? This was his question. And he went to a number of different teachers at the monastery that he was at, and then he went to other local monasteries in Japan, and nobody answered the question to his satisfaction. Until finally one teacher said to him, "You know what, you really need to go to China and see if you can get your question answered there." In China at the time, there was what was called the five houses, the five main houses of Buddhist practice. And it was considered the, as Japan was in decline from a Buddhist perspective, Buddhist practice perspective, China was having its golden age. And so Dogen, who by this time, by the way, in 1221, when he is 21, has received Dharma transmission from one of his teachers, Myozen, in the Rinzai school. I mean, that just is an indication of what a prodigy he was to be given such a elevated transmission at such a young age. He and Myozen go to China so that Dogen can pursue the answer to this question. And this journey to China changes him and changes his practice and changes it forever and informs him deeply of what practice is. And this is what has been passed on directly to each and every one of us and everybody who has passed through, resided in the Soto Zen lineage. And we'll talk about that in the fascicle, the instruction to the Tenzo. Exactly, he captures with great honesty and with great vulnerability this moment of teaching that he received. He received actually a couple of them, but it was from the Tenzo. And it really clarified for him what practice was all about and cleared up his misconceptions at the time. The other thing that happens to him when he goes to China is that he connects with his heart teacher, what we would call a heart teacher, Rujing, R-U-J-I-N-G. But once again, he kind of, like in Japan, he travels around with great curiosity and also with just kind of a thirst for knowledge, a thirst for answers, but more importantly, an openness to find answers from all sources, right? As opposed to just stay in one place. He goes around to a lot of places and he winds up with Rujing. And Rujing immediately recognizes how sincere he is in his practice and how dedicated. And so Ru Jing says, as abbot of the monastery, Ru Jing says, you can come to my quarters at any time, day or night. And this is just an incredibly privileged invitation that he's receiving from this master. And I think maybe Ru Jing was about 52, 56 at the time. And that he would entertain this practitioner in the context of Daizan or Dokusan at any time, day or night, because he knew that Dogen's practice was so sincere and his quest so urgent in a certain way. So this is in 1225 that Dogen connects with Ru Jing. And what he says later is, he says, my great question was answered by meeting Ru Jing. My great, great question was answered. Ru Jing had come from a training background where everything for him was zazen, shikantaza, just sitting. And that was one of the critical things that Dogen picked up from Ru Jing, is this notion of just sitting. And when we, as Dogen says in his teachings to us, when we sit, and if we sit wholeheartedly and with awareness, that is enlightenment. That is realization, and that is enlightenment. And that comes directly from Ru Jing. Ru Jing gave him Dharma transmission. So this guy was, Dogen was much decorated. And he gets Dharma transmission from Ru Jing in 1224. And then Dogen leaves and returns to Japan after Ru Jing dies in 1225. So remember, he's born in 1200, he's 25 years old. And now he returns to Japan, twice Dharma transmitted, and the question of his life answered. And he kind of like what Buddha does. If you remember how after Buddha sits under the Bodhi tree and has his enlightenment, he wakes up and he's not quite sure what to do, right? Should he teach? Can people understand his teaching? Will they be interested? Should he just live his life? And Dogen returns to Japan and kind of goes through the same musing. But he goes to a monastery, Kenin, and he stays there for several years. And that's where he starts writing. He starts writing one of his great works, which is the Shobogenzo Zui Monkey. It is normally referred to as the Shobogenzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye. But the Zui Monkey, as Nancy and I recently learned, is the record of things heard, is what that means to. Most often it is referred to. And this is the collection of fascicles that includes everything from the Genjo Koan, Bendo Wa, mountains and rivers, time being, birth and death, all of his great teachings. And there's something like 97. You know, I'm sure you've seen the volume. It's quite large. And Moon in the Dewdrop and Enlightenment Unfolds are really just a few of those fascicles from the Shobogenzo. The other thing that he writes over the course of his lifetime is called the Eihei Shingi, or the regulations for the auxiliary cloud hall. And these are instructions that he writes to the key officers, seven of them, in a monastery, in the monasteries that he was in. That's how the officers were set up. And this is indeed how San Francisco Zen Center, the mountains and rivers in New York is set up. And I don't know Upaya, I don't know if they follow this, but to this day, there are many places that have the same specific roles of officers. And this is how an officer should comport him or herself and the meaning of their role and how they interact with the monastery and the Sangha. And it is in there that we find instructions to the Tenzo, right? So it doesn't come out of the Shobogenzo. It comes out of the Eihei Shinge. He spends the rest of his life monastically based. He leaves Kenin. He goes and starts a couple of other monasteries before he actually goes and founds the last temple, which is to this day one of the most revered temples in Soto Japanese practice, and that is Eheiji. And he was given land by some wealthy patron, and it is land that is on the northeast of Kyoto and on the border of the Japan Sea, and apparently a place that is known for its very severe weather, although snow does look beautiful on the gorgeous surrounding pine trees. He started having ill health in 1250, and it persisted. He was advised to go to Kyoto to seek medical attention and help in 1253. And en route to going to Kyoto, he suffers another bout of whatever this was, and actually has to stop and stay at the house of a student, not making it to Kyoto. And he's so sick he can't travel any further, and he stays there. And he actually moves into actively dying, and he dies there. There are two things that are said about him while he is at this house of his students in Kyoto. One is that there was some sort of a pole in the room, and he would circumnavigate that and chanting, "I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha." And then the other thing that is said about him, who knows if it is true, that like many other great masters of the past, that he dies in a posture of zazen. But the feeling certainly is that he is a dedicated practitioner, in addition to a teacher and a writer from the beginning to the very end, which I find actually quite inspiring. I believe that he was very, very dedicated, and certainly the volume of writings that he passes on to us, as well as the Eheiji, the establishment of this temple, which is seen as kind of the end all be all for training. And I think from the Soto Shu's perspective, it's probably akin to like a Vatican, if I can even make that type of a parallel. But these are the things that he has left to us, in addition to the example of his own practice. He became somewhat obscured, although he had dedicated disciples who recorded all of his writings and kept them alive. He actually goes into obscurity for several hundreds of years. And it's really only in the 1900s and the 20th century that his writings actually, I think it's when he's discovered here in the West, when Zen comes to the West, and people start going, well, what is this Shobo Genzo anyway? That he is experiences a resurgence of interest. And he is considered, you know, a mystic. You know, you have to read Dogen, as I've said many times, you read him with your heart, not with your discursive mind. Because he can get kind of woo-woo, by which I mean, and this is one of the reasons why I admire him, he is such a deep practitioner, and I think that he has so deeply experienced the absolute by virtue of spending so much time in Zazen, although he merges it with the relative, the phenomenal. But he knows how to speak about both, and he brings them both into his fascicles with great fluency and great fluidity. And I really, really appreciate that he has spent so much time writing about this and trying to capture it. If each of us reflect on what goes through our minds in 5 minutes of Zazen and tries to think about how we might articulately record it, it's quite a task, right? So much happens when we fall into that space and everything opens up. So I deeply appreciate that. And I appreciate also how very encouraging he is. He can be also a very amusing cranky pants. You know, he will talk about how unfortunate it is that these people are so deluded and they practice this way. But he also can be very, very tender and very, very encouraging. So in terms of a couple of his key teachings, I mean, at the base of it is what he really wants is he wants to share with everybody his own passionate quest for liberation and ultimately his verified belief that liberation is possible through Zazen and through practice, right? And this is kind of his starting point always. But there are he's been analyzed now many and kind of from academic perspectives, and so we get lots of different lenses looking at him. But I think that the what we'll see in the instructions to the Tenzo and what is really at the core here of his teachings is this notion of activity and realization. Activity and expression are part and parcel of the circle of enlightenment. So just as I said, if we sit Zazen, then we actually are, and we're sitting it mindfully and wholeheartedly, that is enlightenment. Now that might be a little disappointing to people, but it also, if we are doing it, it's also a feeling of radical presence, right? And it's a feeling of things, our lives, which otherwise can feel so constrained, so narrow, so fractured and fragmented by distractions and worries, internal obstructions, external challenges, etc. But in Zazen, in meditation, it all just opens up, right? So this is the circle that he is talking about: practice, realization, enlightenment. And we go round and round and round. Chop wood, carry water, right? That's quintessential Zen. And behind all of that is this concept that we're going to take a more deeper dive into, which is Menmitsu. Dogen, and I think that this is really important, Dogen doesn't look at practice as there being a superior form or an inferior form. It's not hierarchical in that sense at all. It's not dualistic in that regard. It's not you're better, I'm worse. I'm better, you're worse. It's not like that. He looks at practice in a way that I think is very straightforward and so much more helpful. Is practice authentic or is it inauthentic? Do you feel your practice? Do others feel your practice? You know, and if so, then that to me is reason to continue this journey of enlightenment through this particular methodology that Dogen sets down for us. So this notion is, and I'll just touch on this briefly because it gets a little, requires more time than I have this morning. We have, all of us have that original enlightenment. We are Buddha nature. It's not even a question of having it, we are Buddha nature. And why do we have to practice it? Because if we don't, it just lies dormant. It requires effort in order to be realized, right? And it's seemingly a simple answer, but as we know, it's the practice of a lifetime to continue to make effort, to continue to wake up, to continue, I think, even to trust that I am Buddha nature, that you are Buddha nature, that the chair is Buddha nature, that the sky is Buddha nature, that the ravens and the crows are Buddha nature, and the tree is Buddha nature, that the bell is Buddha nature, that the cup is Buddha nature. The other thing that he talks about, which is, again, quintessential Zen, is that all of this has to be realized through the body. You can think about it and it can be tasty and yummy to kind of think conceptually about what all these ideas are, But in order to really realize the practice for ourselves, it is something that has to be embodied. It has to be felt in our body and expressed through our body. So he says, this is a wonderful book that Janice and I have been studying for a good year. I think we're on page 61. We're not going to run out of text anytime soon. Ehe Dogen, mystical realist. And many people do think that he is, of course, a mystic when you read some of his fascicles. In brief, the samadhi, that being awake and being in connection deeply and fully with your life, of self-fulfilling activity by being aware of the activity that you are engaged with at every moment, is the criterion of the rightly transmitted Buddha Dharma, meaning that the matter of supreme importance in religion is not abstract doctrines and theories, but rather lived experience and activity, which was crystallized in Zazen. So let me read that again. In brief, the samadhi of self-fulfilling activity as the criterion of the rightly transmitted Buddha Dharma meant that the matter of supreme importance in religion was not abstract doctrines and theories, but rather lived experience and activity, which is crystallized through Zazen. So as I have noted for myself and for many others over the years, we come into Zazen, we come into Zen or some form of Buddhist practice, and we think, oh, I need to know all the sutras. Oh, I need all the, to know all the 16 bodhisattva precepts. I need to know all the 36 this and the 10 that and this and that. And that's ultimately not what it is about. That is knowledge, not heart, mind, body, wisdom. Those are all fingers pointing at the moon. The moon is what our experience that we want, that of enlightenment, right? And it is actualized, our practices, when they are authentic, are actualized fully through our body by our feeling, our experience of the feeling of practice. And so tempting though it is to come in, as I did, as I said, for many years, just listening to the Dharma talks, but not having a practice of Zazen, listening to the Dharma talks, but not having a teacher, listening to the Dharma talks, but not studying the precepts. It was all conceptual. It was all about ideas that were very attractive, but it didn't get traction in my life, nor did I get traction in my life until I started to embody the practice. So this is realized, all of this is realized through the body, through our own experience. And this is where we need to trust ourselves, right? Because we think, oh, I don't have practice, but you have practice. Stephen has practice, I don't have practice. Betsy has practice, I don't. We all have practice. We all have our own practice, and we have to trust that and have the feeling of authenticity that our effort is in place and that we are experiencing something. And it is this realization that ultimately leads to our own liberation. So in Dogen, in his own practice, there's just this incredible, and in this whole circle of practice, realization, enlightenment, it's not just, you know, quickly carry the wood over to where it needs to be and throw it down. You do it with great attention and intention. That's a wonderful chapter in Joko Beck's book, The Fire of Intention and Attention. Two things that, you know, we can pay attention to in our own lives to see if they're in place. And this attention to detail, this is menmitsu, okay? When we go to Jikoji, or if you go and spend a protracted period of time at a monastery, you will probably feel it. And for us as practitioners in the wider, more diffuse field, it is harder to experience. It is a form of body training. And we're going to spend some time, hopefully, training our bodies to be aware of memitsu. Sometimes when I was early on in practice, I wondered, why do those priests have to spend so much time with their robes when they sit down? Oh my God, they're folding this, they're straightening that, it takes forever. Can't they just start their talk? Memitsu, attention to detail. The robes have Buddha nature, the robes, the power of the robe. Getting ready, getting settled, paying attention to the body, all of that is equally important. So this memitsu is not a concept. It is a feeling, and it is an expression. It is what each of us can express in our lives and what we feel as an expression of other practitioners when we meet them. And as I said, monastic practice is set up to train people to lead them to that, right? So when you go to a monastery, there are tons of different roles. The chitin, who handles the altar, who makes sure that the incenser is cleaned and all of the old pieces of incense have been taken out and the ashes have been taken out and that it's clean and ready for the next ceremony, that the incense is organized in a particular way. You see this in the kitchen, right, in terms of how we'll see this with the fascicle we're going to study, just how everything is organized and handled with great care. So part of memitsu is form-based, and that's the expression that we feel externally and what we can express. But also a piece of memitsu is internal. You know, and this is, I think, what I really want to make sure that we pay attention to with loving kindness and tenderness during our practice period, are a lot of the internal formations, our ideas, our emotions, that just as I might pick up this cup very carefully with two hands, I might relate to it and feel its texture, its color, the shine, the different pattern of it. It is a hand-thrown cup, the lip of it, the temperature of it, the feel of it in my hands, all of that is memitsu. So also we can have that experience with our internal formations, thoughts and feelings. And as we come out of COVID in particular, where we have been very, very tightly held in many ways, and we start to, like the season of spring, unfurl and bloom and blossom, to give loving attention to all of the feelings that might be needing some after this period of time. But even beyond COVID, you know, just to the long-held habit ideas and feelings we have, to hold them with tenderness, to hold them gently, like a parent lovingly holds their child, to give them that same sort of attention. While I was, of course, enlightened while I was practicing Zazen, I had a couple of internal formations. And one of them was just about missing somebody from my past. And it came on me very suddenly, and it was a very strong feeling. And my first inclination was, I need to do something about this. Have I left something undone there? Do I owe an apology? Should I get in touch with this person? No, if I just paid loving attention, the feeling was just one of missing, longing, yearning for that connection, right? And then I had another internal formation come up, which was Blanche. And just seeing her in her robes in the Buddha hall, caught in a certain slant of sun, her being older, her skin kind of sallow. And I just sat there and just sunk into my feelings and my connection with Blanche. And I was smiling. I felt very warm and I felt very encouraged because this woman was such a dedicated practitioner. And I consider myself so fortunate to have had so much proximate time body to body with her. So much of this, those are not difficult internal formations. We have many others that we know from the karmic crucible of our childhood are more difficult from the challenges of our day to day. All of it deserves loving intention. And so much is going on. When we are embodying Memitsu, we are dropping into our lives in a different way, right? Just the difference between picking up this cup and taking a drink versus picking up the cup with both hands, respecting its Buddha nature, exploring it and its shape, appreciating pattern and color, the glaze on it, the very irregular lip that it has, the feeling of cold, there's some nice sparkling water in here, lifting it to my mouth. That opens up my life in such a different way. Those are all moments of my life. The thing about Memitsu is that it really opens us up to a deeper sense of enrichment than we normally experience by just going very quickly, going very fast, like little Jesus bugs on the top of the creek, right? So I'm looking forward to this class very much and to this wonderful teaching. In advance, I always thank my Dharma brother, Stephen, for the ways in which he generously assists. The other piece of Memitsu, and this is what I want to close with, is that it is a way of bringing us into radical presence, into now. If I am really holding this cup and exploring it and in connection with it, or if I'm having a conversation with Allison and I'm really connecting, I'm in the present. That's where my life is, right? That's what we say in Buddhist practice. We're here, breath by breath, moment by moment, not to be pulled away, right? And so Memitsu is a way of training ourselves to embody and to show up in all the moments of our lives and to feel the radical, rich presence of our lives, moment by moment, breath by breath. I want to just close. And I also want to acknowledge I'm only 8 minutes late. That's not so bad for me. with a poem that's one of my favorites that many of you have heard. And let me see, I can't bring it up on the screen while I am recording. So we'll stop recording.